Welcome to the Launch Button Podcast, where we allot the secrets of successful entrepreneurs and real estate investors who found the courage to hit the launch button and take control of their destiny. Join me, Hugh Zaretsky, best-selling author, seasoned real estate investor, and serial entrepreneur, as we dive deep into inspiring stories and invaluable lessons that will empower you to break free from the ordinary and pursue your true passions. Are you feeling trapped in a job that drains your passion and leaves you yearning for more? Are you ready to accelerate your business and or real estate investing to take it to the next level? It's time to ignite your dreams and embrace the limitless possibilities that life has to offer. Get ready to launch into the life you've always desired by pressing the launch button. Welcome to the Launch Button Podcast, where we allot the secrets of successful entrepreneurs and real estate investors who found the courage to hit the launch button and take control of their destiny. Join me, Hugh Zaretsky, best-selling author, seasoned real estate investor, and serial entrepreneur, as we dive deep into inspiring stories and invaluable lessons that will empower you to break free from the ordinary and pursue your true passions. Are you feeling trapped in a job that drains your passion and leaves you yearning for more? Are you ready to accelerate your business and or real estate investing to take it to the next level? It's time to ignite your dreams and embrace the limitless possibilities that life has to offer. Get ready to launch into the life you've always desired by pressing the launch button.
All right, everybody. We've got an amazing guest here today, Paul Williams. And I first got the chance to meet Paul when we were both speaking at the Humanity Summit. But Paul comes from Indianapolis, Indiana. And he went to college in Florida, started in the corporate world, then took a couple of years off to go to the Peace Corps, and then came back to the corporate world. And now he's working as the Chief Procurement Officer for the University of California entire system. They call it UCOP, University of California Office of the President. He leads a diverse team throughout over 10 campuses, a bunch of research centers, some hospitals as well. And his budget is the size of bigger than most small countries. So, Paul, welcome to the podcast and tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
As you mentioned, I currently lead the system-wide procurement for University of California. As most folks may know, University of California is a network of 10 campuses. So like UC Berkeley, UCLA, Riverside, Irvine, et cetera. We also have 6 medical centers that are research hospitals. And then actually during the pandemic, we acquired about 17, actually lose track if it's 17 or 18, smaller hospitals that are just patient serving that are not research hospitals. And these were basically largely financially distressed hospitals that were in parts of the state that otherwise would not have had medical coverage. And so we wanted to keep these hospitals up and running. And so we agreed to acquire those. So lead that procurement organization. It's interesting, never a dull moment. I tell folks we're buying everything from cleaning supplies up to gene editing technology. So there's no 2 days are the same.
My aunt actually worked for one of your research hospitals. So when I told her I was actually working with you and speaking at some of your events, they were super excited right there.
Oh, that's very cool.
So,
yeah, very cool.
So you were in the corporate world, right? Yeah. So you went to college in Florida, then went into the corporate world like most people do. Took some time off to go to the Peace Corps. What caused that shift for you to take that little break in there?
Sure. So, yeah, as you mentioned, I went to Florida A&M University, the illustrious Florida A&M University on the highest of 7 hills in northern Florida, where I studied business, admin, and marketing. Had originally planned to go to graduate out of college and go straight into the Peace Corps. But that interest was fueled by some Peace Corps volunteers that had come and visited my 4th grade class. And it was a married couple. They had just come back from the Peace Corps. I can't even remember where they were. But that just like kind of sparked an interest, and I've always had an interest in global travel. So I was kind of committed to this idea that after I graduated, I was going to do the Peace Corps. But I ended up doing an internship and then getting an amazing offer to go work in procurement or supply chain at Procter & Gamble. And so that was just an offer that was too good to pass up. Procter & Gamble was a fantastic place to learn. I also was very interested in the notion of what we would now call economic impact, but the idea that you could go in and get involved with large corporate buying organizations and try to help, businesses grow and develop as part of that process in a way that trickles, down through the economy. So I went and started my job at Procter and Gamble, but quite honestly, I was still very much nagged by this kind of desire to do the Peace Corps. And so I kind of committed that I would do 5 years and then do an assessment of if I wanted to continue straight through corporate and do Peace Corps later in life when I retired, or do it, at the end of that 5 years. And so when I got to that 5 years, I had enough career momentum that I felt comfortable that I could step out and go do it. And I'm really glad that I did. I spoke French already, and so got assigned to Morocco, which is a French-speaking country. Because I had this experience with working with suppliers and business development, I ended up doing some work that was first like a feasibility study to see if you could market this town that was about 20 kilometers outside of Marrakesh as a tourist destination and like what would the implications of that would be. And they ultimately decided they didn't want to pursue it because they were like, it's a lot of reason. And then after that, started working with a wealthy, there was a wealthy Moroccan woman who was interested in helping women-owned businesses get their things going. And so I worked with her and that was, came back from the Peace Corps and ended up going back to Procter and Gamble, which is a rare distinction. Like P&G kind of has a, they have two rules. One is they promote from within. So you start at P&G, you move your career up. They also had kind of an unwritten rule that you don't get hired back. Like if you leave, you can't come back. But some rare person that actually got hired back to Procter and Gamble. So did that. And over time, continued jobs that were in procurement and supply chain. For the most part, I'd say kind of my specialty was in organizational transformation. So leveraging ERP systems or leveraging new capabilities to figure out ways to upskill or increase the influence of the procurement organization or try something new. It's like I was at Pfizer, we were applying procurement discipline to the legal spin, which had never been done before. And so continued doing that. And so when I'd reached about 20 some years in corporate, the opportunity came up to join. Had always had an interest in higher ed. Loved the idea of, continuing to do procurement and supply chain. And was really drawn to the fact that UC's mission is pretty squarely aligned with my own personal values, which is mission is three things: world-class education, world-class research, and positive community impact. And that aligned very much with my values. And quite honestly, I love it. I've been here 4 years, and I was telling someone just the other day, I'm as energized now as I was on my first day about being here.
I think one of the huge things, right? You had the core value alignment with the mission, and especially at this point of your career, you really get to choose that, right? You're like, hey, I
Right.
really want to go do that and be a part of that. And I know that's where I think that's where you met Cassie, where through that process, and
Actually, I
then
met Cassie. Funny thing about that is I met Cassie at when I was still at Mondelez, which was the last corporate role that I was in, and met her. She was kind of coaching one of the suppliers that we were also working with, and so met her through that.
And that was our connection. So we met through Cassie, and then we both got invited to speak over at the Humanity Summit over in Portugal. And that's the first time we got to meet face to face. And I got to hear you speak, and you did an amazing job on those
Thanks.
panels and helping that. And you
Likewise.
got to bring your daughter. So what type of
Yeah, that was
experience was
fun.
that for her?
Yeah, that was fun. Like we family has like a family vision statement. And a key component of that family vision statement is to be global citizens. And so we really have tried to raise the kids in a way where they have broad international exposure, that they think of themselves in terms of the broader world and not just limited. Probably like wanderlust from growing up in Indiana. And so whenever we travel internationally, if the opportunity presents, we try to take one of the kids. I've got four kids, so it's difficult to load them all up. So we rotate and we take one of them. And so I took actually two of my daughters have gone to Humanity Summit. So the one that you met, Zora, she was at she went to the Humanity Summit in Portugal. And then the second, and you also met her, Maya, went with me when the Humanity Summit took place in Rio. Yeah. So good experience for her. That daughter actually, she's now a freshman at Howard University. And she just got back from doing like a piano exposition in China. So she's continuing to travel the world.
That's awesome. So tell me w the involvement with the Humanity Summit, obviously part of that core value about helping,
Right.
the global mission and stuff like that. What drove you towards that event? Because that was a brand new event, right? First time they'd ever run it in Portugal. And they were going out there to change, talk about how business corporate world integrates with the private world, right? And you had just made that transition. So what was the driving
Mm-hmm.
force to be out there to speak at that event?
Yeah, I really loved just the foundational principles of the Humanity Summit. I've since joined their board of advisors. Again, supply chain nerd, efficiency nerd, big believer in the power of metrics and the importance of trying to come up with standards and metrics. And really, at the heart of it, what the Humanity Summit is trying to do is figure out what are the ways to measure the quality of life for humanity in a standardized way so that you can objectively look at different places around the globe and A, assess and prioritize projects based on these metrics, and then also look at the current state and look at what progress has been made. So it's just something that appealed to kind of the intersection of my interest in, global cultures, et cetera, my efficiency nerd and supply chain kind of background, and then just this belief that you kind of owe it to the world to try to make it better than it was when you came into it,
So what is that driving force behind you for supply chain? Because that's a unique industry, right? That a lot of people don't know that much about. I did have the fortune of working with Michigan State University way back. I know way back when I was working in tech that we were doing a procurement system for them. But tell people like a little bit more about what that means for people that don't fully understand.
Yeah, I always think of it in terms of like a barbell or a bridge. The barbell model, going back to early days of P&G, was like that's the structure that they use. So if you think about it, you've got the needs of a business on one side, and then you've got the capabilities and the resources to support it on the other. And you are the supply chain process is basically acting as a bridge to figure out what is the most efficient, most effective, most optimized way to connect those requirements to the capability that's out, in the market. And one of the things I'm very passionate about is, economic development and things like that. And that's, I know, a bit of a lightning rod subject in these days because people think of it in terms of diversity and demographics. But I actually really think of it in terms of like efficiency. And again, as a supply chain nerd, if you remove all the demographics and elements of it, and someone were to say to you, there is a pocket of underutilized capability in the market somewhere, sourcing 101, any supply chain leader would tell you, go over there and start exploring. And so that's something that I'm just very passionate about in general. Is this idea of just solving, a bit OCD about just problem solving. And so that is really what supply chain is. It's taking this requirement and problem solving for how are you going to make it as efficient as possible. And then, you want to be selfish. Like if there's more benefit that you can do in that process, let's go for it. If in making the connection to this idea, to this capability, you can also help to, let's say, develop a zip code or improve the economy of a certain zip code, why would you not do that? And so
Right.
that type of benefit is something that's super appealing to me.
Well, I see that with you. I mean, we're talking about some AI stuff we're doing, and you're like, well, I can connect you here, right? It's like, well, it's for you, Paul. Like, we're doing this for you first. Like, but you're always thinking about the other people. So that's one of the things that's amazing about what you do. And now, as a person, and you're in corporate because there's a certain standard in corporate. And then when you shift to private, right, there's different, it's almost like a different game, right? Because some of the things you could do in corporate, you can't like walk into private and like, fire everybody and like rebuild the staff, right? Like you can do in corporate world, you come in, lay off a bunch of people, but in the private sector, you can't. So when you made that transition, what's been one of the biggest things that you've had to sort of learn or change on as a leader to work within that industry?
There's probably the two biggest things are slowing down. So I have been in, for the most part, like high growth companies and like large CPG or pharma that were making changing fast. And so in academia in particular, so like we're in the private sector in academia, that culture of slow study that is what drives academia and research does trickle over into the administrative functions. And so people, you say measure twice, cut once, they measure like four times and then cut once. And the pace at which you try to drive change in the organization here also happens much, much slower because these are stable, long-standing 160-year-old bureaucracies that are there. And so as a public-facing organization, you have to move very, conservatively. And so things actually move much slower in the public higher ed side than in corporate. The other big thing that I would say is the motivators for influencing behavior are very, very different. So in the private sector, for the most part, the P&L is the holy grail, right? If you can align, if you can show a benefit to the P&L, that's what gets your project forward. When you're prioritizing, you're for the most part, you're prioritizing by impact on the P&L or share price. And even incenting people to get on board with it, like the employees on your team, for the most part, you can say, okay, guys, we're going to charge this hill. It's because it's going to make X impact on the P&L, and it's going to get you this much bonus if you deliver it. And people
Right.
will run for that. The public sector does not have a bonus structure. There is not a P&L. And even there, the P&L is not the primary mission of the university. Even within the university system, each campus has its own focus area. Each department within that campus has their own focus area. Each researcher within that department has their own focus area. And so it's fun. It's almost a level up in terms of influencing, because you don't have this kind of one Rosetta Stone that you can use, or you know, that translates for everybody. You have to really get in and understand what's motivating someone, and then figure out how to get them on board. And again, even as a people leader, we're in the Bay Area, right? So people that are doing supply chain work in this team could easily be working for some of the larger tech companies that are here that may pay a lot more or have a, you know, sexier product. They're choosing to work here because they're in some way motivated by the mission of the university. And what that means to them varies person by person. So you have to really get in and try to understand the person. So it forces me to slow down, forces me to really understand on an individual basis, like how to influence. And so it's pretty cool, like much more difficult. But as someone who was pretty far in my career and had done a bunch of different transformations, it's kind of exciting to be challenged with a new way of doing it.
Yeah, that's a great learning experience, right? You said you like to learn and tinker
Right.
and do all that. So I'm sure that that's driving a lot of that as you're going forward with this. And then in the procurement space and, in the shifts that have happened this year, you've really had to redesign, right, your committees, your different things that you do to get feedback from. What was, how has that impacted what you guys are doing? Is that speeding things up? Is that helping?
You know, this year is one of the terms that, you know, you probably heard it. And as a thought leader, I'm sure you're very familiar with the concept of VUCA, you know, volatile, uncertain, chaotic. And this has been a very VUCA few years. So starting with the pandemic, which, you know, really brought supply chain challenges more to the forefront, followed by kind of folks rethinking global supply chains. You know, for decades, it had been all about globalizing, moving to low-cost countries, very little consideration to distance to the final destination. But when the pandemic hit, and it caused folks to really rethink some of that. So now there's a shift of do we onshore, or do we move it closer, you know, things like that. So there was a disruption in supply chains there. Then you tack on, you know, the tariffs that have been brought on by the Trump administration, and there's a lot of volatility, you know, there in terms of how you think about what you buy and where you buy it from. And so that has caused us to really rethink things that we're how we buy, where we buy it from. One things I'm really proud of my team for here at the university is because of the types of relationships we have with our suppliers, and because we were able to move quickly to get data in the hands of the people that are making buying decisions here. We actually really minimized the amount of tariff impact that we had relative to most other procurement organizations. And to me, that really showed how much procurement is a balance of a data game and a relationship game, because it was having solid data to enable conversations with people that we had good relationships with that enabled us to, as of now, you know, keep our tariff impacts low. That said, it's a volatile, you know, uncertain time. So, you know, we have to continue to focus on that.
Yeah, and the beginning of this year was the big shift for Paul does a lot of committees and gets a lot of feedback from different people out there, and as well as the university does from their suppliers, from their different vendors, right? Like, I know you had some concerns at the beginning of the year. You brought me in to run one of the events just to make sure that we could keep everybody on track and staying out of politics and into your mission. But that was also a big shift for your internal team to be like, hey, let's stay out of politics and let's focus on what we got to get done. How did you foresee that? Because a lot of people were slower to react to that. How do you foresee those changes, right? Politics would stand in, whichever side people are on doesn't matter, but you're like, we got to deliver and move forward. How do you sort of screen that out? Because I think that's a big issue in our country right now is I think people are very more closer together in the middle, but people are being divided by things outside, and it's prevented businesses from growing, universities from growing, different people from communicating.
You know, the interesting thing, like overall, we continued to grow during this time. So, like, enrollment at the university is still at a record high. The university also, despite some incredible financial challenges associated with federal budget cuts, we are still able to have 60% of our students graduate with no debt, which is something I'm extremely proud of. And as a procurement leader, especially proud of it because we actually directly help contribute to that. So, you know, in addition to negotiating pricing and terms and things like that, we also negotiate for things like grants for students and internships for students and equipment donations to the university that, you know, allow us to do things like, you know, have about 40 some percent first generation college graduate students, or, you know, again, 60% graduate with no debt. So those types of things are really important to us. And again, there's an element of politicization of some of these things that really did not need to be there before. So, for example, if you say these first generation students, many of those first generation students are also the children of immigrants. One could go down a whole path about immigrants and yada, yada, yada. But at the end of the day, these are students who are residents and citizens of the state of California that are building the future job force for the state of California. And so it benefits everybody to support them. You know, similarly, at the beginning of the year, you know, we within California, since the 90s, have had Proposition 209, which prohibits the use of demographic information when making public buying decisions. So when, you know, some of the anti-DEI initiatives came out earlier in the year, we were not as impacted as some of the other public universities or some of the other states because we had basically been operating that way, you know, for quite some time. So we didn't have as much impact. But again, I would go back to the idea that removing all demographics aside, it still makes good business sense. So even now, we still do proactive outreach to make sure that all communities are aware of the opportunities to do business with us, even though we absolutely never assign points or an advantage based on demographics. Helps everybody, and it helps us to have a more competitive RFP process for us to be reaching out to make sure everybody's aware of the opportunities that are there. And again, it benefits the state overall. So yeah, it's been an interesting time. But for the most part, we've been able to stay the course with the things that we're working on. As you alluded to, we're much more we had to do some education just to make sure that folks were more careful in their language and did not say things that, you know, would put us in the crosshairs by kind of misstating things. Other than that, you know, we've been able to still have the same results that we had in the past in terms of positively impacting the community. And that's something I'm super proud of.
Well, yeah, like from that first meeting, you had set the agenda like we're gonna like you because I was there, right? I was like, you set that agenda like we're not talking about this, it doesn't play. And then the second meeting we ran 6 months later, or roughly about that time, everybody was focused on the mission, right? Everybody was
Yeah,
focused on the mission,
100%.
and that comes from strong leadership, right? Whether
Thank
that's
you.
corporate or private, it's about strong leadership, setting the mission, the vision, and being like, we're not tolerating this, we're gonna focus on. No matter what happens outside your walls that you can't control, you set the vision that, hey, we're gonna go do this and this is the mission and we're gonna go hit our metrics. We're gonna keep everybody involved, right? We're not changing our practices, but you're doing that. So you have the Economic Impact Committee and some other committees out there doing that. What is the mission behind those to help you as the chief procurement officer for the University of California, right? What's the goal with those? What's the thought behind that? Because that seems a very unique program that a lot of universities don't have.
No, you know, most universities do actually have, especially public universities do have some type of program around economic impact.
Okay.
So actually not that abnormal in that way. I think most, and the rationale is the same. Like universities are typically, and we definitely are, a huge influence in the communities that we're in. We want to make sure that we're doing everything possible to support the economies of the communities that we're in and that those economies are thriving. That's in our own best interest. It's also just a reasonable mandate given that we receive state funds, right? So important for us to sow back into the taxpayers that paid for us to be there. And so, you know, that's just part of our mission. But to be honest, we're actually not that unique. Most higher ed organizations have some level of focus on making sure that they're supporting the communities that they're in. One of the things that we're starting to do at UC that's a little bit more unique is we also are making sure that we're proactively supporting our alumni. You know, we have a lot of alumni founders, you know, whether they're tech founders or even mom and pop or commercial retail folks. We just want to make sure that we're including them in the ecosystem of things that we buy. Again, just like everybody else, it's a very open, transparent process. They have to compete, they have to win the business, but we are actually making sure that we're being proactive and making them aware of what opportunities there are to do business with us. And then one of the things we are working on that I'm also quite proud of that you've been a part of helping us develop is creating opportunities for these businesses to access capital. So we have an access to capital committee that is working on building out a platform that helps to connect businesses that need capital with people who are willing to provide capital. If you were to survey business owners, especially medium and small business owners, on what are their biggest challenges, one of the top three every time is going to be the availability of capital. And so these days, especially with AI technology, we have the ability to try to match them with people that can provide them with capital, you know, at scale. And as the tool's getting developed, we're starting to put in the ability to like do a readiness assessment and kind of coach these businesses to help them be better prepared for the match when they go for the capital. So that's something that I'm really excited about that we're working on. It'd be a bit of a game changer, and I really appreciate the committee that you're a part of that's helping us to build that out. That's a model that I think will not only benefit the state of California, but will benefit industry across the country, possibly even globally.
Yeah. And well, you guys jumping into the AI, right? Super fast versus going into it, right? Being able to say, hey, we need something to that and to help your procurement people on that side. So for people that want to get into supply chain management, for people that are like, hey, I have a business and I want to work with a university or I want to work with a bigger company, since you guys have some crazy stats at the University of California. You know, I know you guys produce, what is it, like 5 patents a week or something like, or a
A day,
month?
a day. Yeah.
Like 5 patents a day come out of the university system. Like you said, you've got all these startups, you've got all these founders. So for people that are starting up and then want to go work, you know, with the larger company, what are some of the things that they should have lined up before they come, you know, talk to somebody of your caliber or your system's caliber?
Yeah, great question. The things I'm going to say are probably true for any large buying organization. You know, the first is just have your basics in place. Like there's a certain level of insurance that any large organization is going to have. Have a really clear capability statement so they can understand kind of what it is that you're doing. The other is really understand the business that you want to approach. So really understand if, whether it's their physical supply chain or the services that they're tapping into or their IT needs. Do as much research as you can to understand what that business is currently doing, what their needs are. You know, again, going back to this idea of the linkage between their requirements and what's in the market, understanding their requirements will help you as a supplier understand what needs are there in that business. So understanding that as much as possible is great. Taking the time to understand how decisions are made within that organization is also very helpful. I remember once, this is a different company, I had someone who was set to start providing cocoa for this a very large cocoa buying organization. And they were a startup, but they could have been a big disruptor in the market. And they asked for a meeting with the CPO. And rather than connect them with the CPO, I went to the CPO and the CPO said, hey, connect them with the cocoa buyer. Because the cocoa buyer was more junior on the org chart, these folks got offended and kind of walked away from the deal. But what had actually happened from a decision-making standpoint is the CPO had basically advanced them closer to the decision maker. So understanding like how decisions are actually made in that organization is also extremely important. One big tip that I give folks for public procurement is that everything is transparent. And so on the corporate side, you may have to go build relationships and talk to a lot of folks and do a lot of networking to get that picture of what the requirements are and how decisions are made and how the bids were scored and things like that. On the public side, this is all publicly available. So you can actually go and Google whatever it is that you're buying in the past few RFPs for the organization that you're about to approach. And so you really kind of no excuse for not being like very well prepared, for those things. The other thing I would always recommend is tap into what we call the community-based organizations. So there's chambers of commerce, small business networks, all of these organizations that will typically have supplier development as well as pretty well-established networks inside of the buying side that you can tap into. So would highly recommend that as well.
Yeah, and I know one of the biggest complaints I've heard from your team since I've been to a couple of meetings now is that some people are just, going to AI, doing some quick research, and then just submitted that in, and your team's like, this is the same response from like three vendors, right? Like, and not taking even the time to like customize the AI responses. So you're not against them using AI, you just want them to, right? Your team wants them to like make sure you modify it, like you said, and adjust it for us.
Yeah, 100%. It's like I tell my kids, use AI as a strength booster, not as a substitute for work. So use AI for deeper analysis or for scenario analysis or things like that. Don't use the AI to answer the RFP question, which has actually happened. Like we've gotten RFP responses where we can see that these two people both put the question into an AI and got, verbatim the same answer. You don't want to do that. But what you can do that's helpful is say, put in the parameters of the company of your company. Hey, I provide this IT service and it does XYZ. I've got this many folks and where I've got these customers. I'm going to approach Corporation X and I would like to target their part of their business. Tell me the things that I should consider. Tell me how you would assess my opportunity for success. And if I wanted to build a relationship with someone there, who should I talk to? That's a prompt that would actually be helpful for somebody
Right.
trying to get into a corporation.
Yeah. And I also want to save your team time and energy and effort. So when somebody sees this and they're like, oh, just right. So we give them better, don't give the AI response and cut and paste it in. Because I mean, whether that's in school, like you said, for your kids, whether that's for your procurement bid, like people are going to see it and know it, right? Like then they don't really trust your answers and you don't want to lose that trust.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is trust. We are one of the things we're doing at the university that is an exciting project is a partnership with the XPRIZE Foundation. And the XPRIZE Foundation is a nonprofit that helps to drive breakthrough innovation by offering cash prizes for solutions to tough problems. So the thing that they're probably most known for is commercial space flight. So before there was any commercial space flight, they said, hey, we've got, I think it was like $30 million or $40 million for whoever can come up with a reusable space vehicle, get it into space, bring it back, and launch it again 24 hours later. So they did that. The team that won that is what became Virgin Galactic. But in addition to that, all the other teams that did submissions were eventually stood up as companies that are providing the technology that drives the commercial space flight industry, which is now like over $1 trillion. Anyway, we're partnering with the XPRIZE Foundation to look at economic impact and global trade. As I mentioned before, we're in an interesting time where global trade dynamics are very much shifting. We also have this, foundational premise that if you can, the more you diversify the number of players who are there, the better it is for everyone. So figuring out a way to make sure that global trade is happening in a more equitable and more accessible way, as particularly as things. So we're working on that with XPRIZE, and I'm really excited about what the impact of that could be, for us ongoing. But it also is an example where folks should start thinking about, AI tools, things like that. How do they get into that mix?
Yeah, and that's where you guys have been on the forefront, and then you do some stuff with right WeBank and some women's organizations. So you're all over the place helping the world globally. I know you were down at one of their big conferences recently. So how do you, as a, you're running one of the largest university procurement systems, right, in the country. You're going to these conferences, you've got the four kids. How does that life balance play in for you? What's some of the tips and tricks you can give for founders?
Oh, great question. First of all, I feel very blessed. I operate on a very small amount of sleep, so that gives me a little bit of extra hours in the day. But to be honest, I think some rituals around kind of mindfulness and centeredness is very important for ensuring that, so every morning I try to spend, a bit of time, like first reading, usually some spiritual text. I spend some time in prayer and meditation for probably 30 to 40 minutes. And then I do a word puzzle because I'm getting older and I want to make sure that I do the New York Times puzzles just to get the mind going. But I think taking that time to kind of prepare myself mentally for the day is very helpful, particularly like the prayer meditation time, I think is just critical. So I think that's important. For family, I've got some pretty hard, fast rules. Like we've got fixed, my kids are teens, so they're now in sports and mock trial and activities and stuff like that. That caused their evening schedules to be busy. So we've just set as a principle, like this Monday night is family dinner night. So whatever you're going to do, whatever activity you're going to be in, you cannot have a practice on that day. And that time with family, just to make sure that we're connecting, is super important. Someone gave me the advice very when my kids were younger to not walk in the door on the phone, so that in the minute that you come in the house, you're always, connecting with your kids first. I found that to be invaluable. And then I'm just a big believer in work hard, play hard. I'm probably like borderline ADHD. So like, pretty good, pretty high energy levels to be able to work a full day, but then go make sure that I'm balancing it out with like a concert or some art or something like that. So just being mindful about it, is important.
I think that's huge. I've never heard that one about, not being on the phone when you walk in the door. But yeah, I think that way you're ready to make the transition. Especially as guys, sometimes we need that transition time of shifting from mode to mode, right? Kind of you carrying one into the other.
And when they gave it to me, when they told me, it was more in the context of like when your kids are little, you open the door and they run in, they're like, "Daddy," they're just excited. And they basically said, "You're going to reach a day where your kid does not do that and you're going to miss it. So don't give up any of those instances of your kid being able to come in and run to you at the door." And that was very true. But even as the kids older, I still just find it's valuable to be able to get in, walk into the door and get kind of the pulse check of the house, undisturbed, when you walk in, helpful.
Yeah, that's awesome. So for people that want to get more involved or support their local communities, because I know you do a lot of that, what are some of the tips or tricks to balance that also, or corporations to be able to give back and play in the space more? Because I think that's
The big thing, couple big things I would say is for corporations and large buying organizations, please don't walk away from those community-based organizations that historically were doing what was used to be called supplier diversity. Again, most of those most that they're supporting still fall in the category of small businesses. That, like I think more than 90% of the businesses that historically were certified as diverse or women-owned are still small business, and this country runs on small business. The vast majority of this country are small businesses, and so for corporate buyers or hired by business. So to corporate folks, I would just say please continue to engage with those community-based organizations that are supporting small business and figure out ways to get engaged. Veteran-owned businesses as well. I think we owe it to folks that have served the country that to help them to drive their businesses forward. For other folks, I just say follow your passion. Just remain curious. That's probably true. My big advice for everybody on everything: just remain curious, and you will eventually find someone, some organization that is something that you are passionate about, and that you can bring your skill sets to in a helpful way. It just like just by just one of the there's many challenges how connected we are, but one of the many benefits of how connected we are, digitally connected we are, is it's very easy to find your tribe and find what something that you can get involved with in a positive way.
Okay, awesome. And then I know As you are growing the Economic Impact Committee and the events around that and the outreach, the next big event is going to be the live event's going to be in March. And we're talking about incorporating more outside vendors and people to get involved to understand the message behind the University of California procurement, as well as supporting the different communities. And that those conferences have growing. What is your that as we move into 2026 and beyond for that?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of just go full circle. Like, we as a university are in a position we are facing a financial reality in terms of what our budgets look like. We remain committed to supporting the state and businesses in the state. And so, our goal or objective for continuing to have these programs is to make sure that we are looking at ways to deliver on the mission of the university while coming up with a cost structure that can exist in the new financial reality, and then also still continue to deliver on those foundational missions. And then, kind of number three out of those three, again, world-class education, world-class research, and community impact. That third one is connected to ensuring that as we spend the billions of dollars that we spend, we're being mindful to tap into all of the communities that ultimately fund us. And again, I'll say everybody, that's just good sourcing, to continue to look for on this balance of the requirements and the supply base. You got to keep mining and looking for where players are in the supply base, keeping the door open for that. And then, of course, part of that community impact and the student impact and the research impact is connected to us working with our alumni and people that are doing business with us to help to support them to become successful businesses as well. And so, strong interest in doing that also.
And in the future, I know those may be opened up more to the public when we get to that point, as you're growing that, and then be able to, bring in some outside speakers and different things, and get more and more exposure in that space as well.
Yeah, that is planned. And I'll make sure to give you the URL that folks can go to learn about the programs that we have going, and also learn how to register with us as a potential supplier. I'll caveat that move slowly, and we have a lot of people that are interested in doing business with us, but the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. So first step is get out there and register yourself as a potential supplier with us.
Well, and that's exactly what you said. When you came from corporate to the private thing, things move much slower. And so just be able to understand that, and even just to be involved to support the difference, anything like that. Any other thoughts, things that you think people should know as they're entering either to with the university or work with a bigger company as they take their small business? Because I actually learned this attending one of your events, like the definition of a small business is pretty high, actually, according to the University of California. It's some It's like over like $10 million you got to generate, or 22, depending on what it is.
It depends, to be honest. So we use the definitions that are of the Small Business Association. Small Business Administration. So those are like federal guidelines, and but they are typically pretty high compared to what most folks think of when they think of a small business. It's actually a pretty complex chart because it depends upon what sector. So a small business in an agricultural sector versus a small business in catering or food, like the threshold is very different. You got to go out to the SBA and look at it, what it is for your area, but it is pretty consistently much higher than most folks think. So yep, 100% on that.
Yeah. So advice for them as they want to, any last thoughts, whether it's on the global impact, whether it's on the supplier development.
My biggest thing, and that's kind of what I said a couple of minutes ago, is remain curious. And in terms of always thinking, understanding what's going on in the macro sense of the markets that you're serving, and remain curious in terms of really trying to understand the specific buying organizations that you're trying to. Or that you're trying to sell to, I guess not just the buying organization, but the whatever organization they're in. Really understanding that is important, and then just always be looking for ways to like continuously improve. The other thing I would say is always be networking. So understand it's all trust. Everything is built upon trust. That's actually what I was getting at when I mentioned the X Prize. Is we as part of that process of trying to do this X Prize trade exchange, we've interviewed over like 100 folks around the globe who are supply chain and procurement experts. And the most consistent theme by far for all of them, that as the most critical necessity for driving business, is trust, the ability to build trust. And that does not necessarily happen sitting behind a screen. You got to get out and connect with people in order to build that trust.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for trusting me with your group there,
You've
and
been awesome.
to, well, thank you. Speak with them and get to know your family and get to know your organization and the way you're doing it. And I love helping out on the technology side now as we're building out that platform. But you put a lot of in me in that very first meeting, so I really appreciated it at a very unique time in our history. And I want to thank you for that opportunity.
No, thank you very much for being willing to partner with us. You've brought a lot to the team and to to the working on inside of that team. And I think you do embody the idea of just curiosity and thinking, always kind of thinking of different ways in which you can contribute to the problems that are trying to be solved. And so I thank you and appreciate you for being willing to share that with us and our mission. It's been great.
Well, yeah, and you opened my eyes to a lot of things. So I gotta appreciate you for that and sharing your family and being there. And that's one of the biggest things. Like, you heard how humble Paul is. You guys don't even know how, like, he controls more funding than most, and yet here he is on our podcast. Here he is sharing his knowledge willingly, right? Being able to do that because he does embody that thought of, I want to make a bigger impact. I want to help more people. And hopefully, as you guys are watching this, you're able to follow, you're able to get involved, you're able to help people, or even refer people that have small businesses in California on how they should step up and work better with the university. And I know that's something that'll be big moving into 2026. And just get involved where you can to support people and raise people up, like the generosity that Paul is showing with us here today. So, from our Launch Button family, to your family, to the University of California, I look forward to all the great things that we can do. I want to thank you for your time and appreciate everything you're doing. And we've got your back wherever you're going.
Thank you for joining us on the Launch Button Podcast, your gateway to unlocking your true potential and pursuing your passions. Don't let the journey end here. For more empowering insights, valuable resources, exclusive content, and free giveaways, visit www.thelaunchbuttonpodcast.com. Thank you for joining us on the Launch Button Podcast, your gateway to unlocking your true potential and pursuing your passions. Don't let the journey end here. For more empowering insights, valuable resources, exclusive content, and free giveaways, visit www.thelaunchbuttonpodcast.com. At The Launch Button, we're dedicated to helping you break free from the ordinary and embrace a life filled with purpose and fulfillment. Dive deeper into our episodes, access bonus materials, and connect with like-minded individuals on our website and our private community group. Are you ready to take the next steps towards your dreams? Subscribe to The Launch Button Podcast on your favorite podcast platform and never miss an episode. Remember, the power to transform your life lies within your grasp. Press the launch button and soar towards success. For more updates, behind-the-scenes content, and exclusive offers, follow us on social media, join the conversation using hashtag the launch button, and share your journey with our vibrant community. Thank you for being a part of the Launch Button family. Together, let's ignite our dreams and embark on this journey together of growth and discovery. Visit www.thelaunchbuttonpodcast.com and let's continue to launch your greatness. See you there.